God said, Let there be light, and there was light, and God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and there was evening, and there was morning, one day. Whatever creation account you go by, there's no doubt about it, light is a fundamental part of the universe. But what is it? Matter? Energy? Or something else? And how have scientists gone about explaining it? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
During this conversation, we'll undertake no less than a history of light, or at least a history of human explanations of it. And our guest is Peter Sobel, honorary fellow in the History of Science Department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Welcome back to University of the Year.
Great to be back. Thank you.
Well, let's start with that biblical notion of light as something that's not darkness, that's not night. What exactly is light, according to that account, and where did scientists take it?
Well, that particular light has been a theological question for quite a long time, and a lot of people believe that it couldn't possibly be the light that we see from the sun because the sun and moon aren't created until the fourth day. St. Augustine in the 4th century A.D. believed that that reference referred to the creation of the angels, which creation is nowhere else mentioned in Scripture, so it was a good idea for him to put it there. But the light that I would like to talk about today is a different kind of light. It's the kind of light that we can do experiments on, the kind of light that we do see coming from the sun and from flames and things like that.
Experiments that were conducted back in biblical times? What kind of experimentation would be available?
The story really begins with an attempt to understand vision. You don't see a lot of concern with what light is back in the early days. Back in ancient Greece, when this sort of inquiry into nature really began, what you find is people wondering how vision occurs.
That's true. No light, no vision. So that brings it right home, doesn't it?
But exactly how does light make vision possible? And in fact, one of the theories that was proposed was that a thing's objects all have their a bit sort of streaming off of them, that everything sheds a little shell of itself, a very fine shell, and that passes through the air unperturbed somehow until it reaches your eye. This theory was never really taken seriously by many people, as far as I know, because there was no explanation for why you can see a huge mountain that fits against your eye or why these thin shells don't crash into each other and become completely dissociated. The real problem with vision was to understand the coherence of the visual image. How was it that a correct one-to-one mapping of the image with the object got to your eye? So this idea that something came from the object to your eye wasn't working. There was the opposite view that something comes out of your eye and goes to the thing that you see. Although, strictly speaking, that wasn't held in antiquity. The people who believed in antiquity that something comes out of your eye to help you see believed that whatever this was would mix with the air, which when illuminated by the sun or by some flames would allow something to pass back and forth. It's not really clear. There was a physician named Galen who lived in the 2nd century AD, and he believed that whatever emerged from the eye made this coalesced material a sensitive substance. It was like an extension of your eye all the way up to the visible object.
All the way up to the mountain 50 miles
away.
Yeah,
well, that's right. So the people who didn't agree with this theory disagreed with it for that very reason, that not only does it seem that you can see a mountain as soon as you open your eye, but you can see the stars. How is it possible that something emerges from your eye and covers that distance so rapidly?
What did Aristotle think?
Aristotle believed that the medium was somehow crucial because, and he says this in several places, if you put something on your eye, you can't see it. That meant that the medium was doing something, that there was something, that it was an intermediary in the strict sense, not just placed between the object and the eye, but it was actually part of the process. And he seems to have believed that some quality, that the color of a thing, that that quality was capable of passing through the medium to your eye without being attached to anything material. And this was a sort of accidental quality. Aristotle talked about the substance of a thing, and then it has accidents, and the accidents can change without changing what the thing is. A color of a thing is an accidental quality, and it is somehow able to reach your eye instantaneously through this medium.
They must
not
have
well explained.
Been driven kind of crazy by such things as refraction and lenses in some primitive form and reflections.
Well, they knew all about mirrors. In fact, they studied mirrors quite a lot. And a few of them, the mathematician Euclid, who lived in the 4th century BC, and a later thinker named Ptolemy, who was more famous, I guess, for his astronomy, both of them decided that maybe it wasn't so important what light is or how things get to your eye, but let's draw these lines from the visible object to your eye, and let's see what we can learn about that. These are called ray diagrams, and they do end up looking a lot like what we would draw today if we were doing ray tracing diagrams. And they were able, using this kind of geometry, to show why the images in mirrors appear to be where they do. They could explain why an object looks smaller when it's farther away. If you draw these lines out from the eye out to the object, the angle between the two lines will get smaller the further this object is away. It doesn't matter what's going in what direction. It still shows you why this thing appears smaller.
What about the reversed images in mirrors or the flipped images?
Yep, you could do that too.
Lens?
All you had to
just
do was
draw the lines a little differently.
Draw the lines differently. I mean, they knew about concave mirrors and convex mirrors, and they knew where the image would appear. They knew that light was bent by glass and by water. In fact, Ptolemy had a table in his book on optics, has tables of refraction for a light going from air into water and from air into glass and from water into glass. He even tried to come up with a law of refraction and how does the angle of incidence, if you draw a perpendicular line at the surface where the light comes in and you measure the angle from that perpendicular to the ray, that's the angle of incidence, and then you measure the angle of refraction by, again, measuring it from that perpendicular extended into the substance. And it was a problem for a long time to find out how these two things related, the incident and refracted angle. And Ptolemy had this law, which turns out to have been, or his table of data turns out to have been fudged so that his law would look as if it worked. But in fact, it works only for very small angles of incidence. Once you get further away from that normal, that perpendicular, it doesn't work anymore.
Did they have any sense of what causes colors?
No, colors were sort of an irreducible quality for the ancient world. For Aristotle especially, things are red because there's redness in them. And that's pretty much it.
Well, if you look at the ancient world, the Romans and the Greeks, who gets the closest to getting it right?
By our opinions?
Yeah.
Or where you look at them and you think, wow, they were ahead of their time.
It's hard to say. I mean, we like to think that the atomists, these people who had this idea of the thin films, were sort of on the right track because we do see because things go into our eye, but they didn't know what it was that was going in. It took a whole lot of conjecture and going way out on limbs in order to figure this out. And really that sort of going out on a limb happens throughout the history of this idea. Light is just so strange that if you stay within your comfort zone, you never figure it out.
Now, we've been talking mostly about Western science, but what about in the Arabic world? What kind of work were they doing on light?
Well, they get all the books, most of the books, by the Greeks, and they're very interested in this work. And they make the move that says everything in nature radiates something of itself. And one example of this is its visual qualities are radiated from it. But it's not matter. It's not like what the atomists believed. It's something later on in the Latin West, they'll say it has intentional being. So it's something that can go out from every point on a visible object in every direction and not interfere, not crash into other such things. And that helps because now you can get toward retaining the coherence of a visual image. If every point on your eye is getting something from every point on the visible object, then you've explained what the atomist could not explain.
I suppose it's fair in a way to think of that kind of substance or medium emanating from the object perceived. If you look at the analogy that both sound and smell provide, in which case there is something emanating from that object.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. And when people become familiar with magnets, that's just another example of it. Some things have this virtue, and it's spread out from the object in every direction. So that's right. There was some precedent for thinking that things spread out this way. Later on, people will differentiate between how the senses work, and vision remains sort of strange in that they decide that you hear because of vibrations and you smell because particles of the thing actually do waft away and reach your nose. But light remains strange because of how quickly it happens and because of the straight lines that it happens in. Sound easily goes around corners, so do odors, but light doesn't. So this idea...
There was something different about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it seems in so many cultures to be linked with the divine.
Yes, that's
which I suppose if you're a scientist and you're working on light in the early times, it would be difficult to keep those two things separate.
Well, yes and no. I mean, just in general, in the Latin Middle Ages, which is what I know best, they were quite willing to grant to the Faculty of Arts in the universities the business of talking about nature and talking about how it is that you see. And theologians would worry about the light that was mentioned on that first day of creation, the one that Norman read. So that there's a division of labor there that worked out pretty well for them.
And in the Middle Ages, what sorts of advances are made in terms of concepts of light?
Well, the books by the Arabs and books by the Greeks begin to arrive in the West in the 12th and 13th century. And this is at a time when the university schools are starting up. And so these new books really increase the rapidity with which big schools can be established, and they're just eating this stuff up. And I have to read this quote here because it's one of my favorites from this history. It's from a man named Robert Grosseteste, who was the Bishop of Lincoln, who died in probably 1253. And he is reading these books by the Greeks and by some of the Arabs. And he wrote a book about the rainbow. I wish I could go off and talk about that. That is also a part of this story, but it's a part we can't get to today probably. Anyway, in his book about the rainbow, though, Grosseteste is talking about what the Latins call the science of perspective. And that's about this fact that things radiate their natures and about how it reaches the eye in the case of vision and what happens at every stage of the way from the object all the way up into the brain. So he's writing about perspective, and he says, and this part of perspective, I think he's talking about ray diagrams here, like what Euclid and Ptolemy were doing. So this part of perspective, when perfectly understood, shows us how we may make things far away appear very close, and how we may make large things that are close appear very small, and how we may make small things far away appear as large as we like, so that it would be possible for us to read small letters from incredible distances, or to count sand or grains or seeds or any small things. So here's Grosseteste in the first half of the 13th century, and he's already understood what can be done with light and bending it with lenses in just the proper way. He doesn't do it, and who knows why. We do know that right around this time, people start showing up in paintings holding spectacles. Mm-hmm. So at this time, somehow people have learned that you can do this with glass and improve certain visual problems.
So there is a demand for this. This is not just theoretical science. It's a very practical science.
Well, we don't know to what extent the theory influenced the making of these spectacles. You see people in frescoes. There's one that I saw once where it's some donors and saints admiring the Virgin with the child. the donors who paid for the painting like to be depicted in the painting.
Yes.
And here was a guy, and he's not wearing them. He's holding them in his hand. And I think that's middle 13th, late 13th century, and that is supposedly one of the earliest depictions of spectacles. But this is a problem with the Middle Ages, that the people that really did things may have had no connection at all with the theorists.
Well, when someone like Isaac Newton comes along, what would he have learned in school about light? What would he have been told about light, and how did he add to that body of knowledge?
Wow, that's a good question, what he might have learned. He could very well have been reading some of the old perspectivist tracts. He probably had a good dose of geometrical optics. But there probably wasn't much beyond what Aristotle believed about what light actually was. Now, one of the first things that Newton does in this regard is in 1666, according to his own recollection, he wanted to play with a prism and look at what he calls the celebrated phenomenon of colors. So he got a good prism and he punched a hole in his window shade and allowed the light to shine onto the prism and then looked at the beautiful colors that were created beyond it. But apparently he was one of the first people, if not the first, to put the screen or the wall on which the colors were projected very far away from the prism. And he was struck by the fact that instead of being a round image, it was quite spread out. It was quite oblong. And he seemed to think at this point that, look at that, the blue is bent by the prism a whole lot more than the red is. Now, at this point in history, people are still not sure that it isn't the prism that's creating these colors out of this light. So Newton at this point took a screen with another hole in it so that he could adjust which color from the first prism landed on this hole. First it would be the red, and then he could bend it through the green and then to the blue. And he passed that light through another prism, and nothing further happened. The blue light didn't break again into more different colors of light. Later on, he managed to recompose white light out of the different colors. So this was the first evidence that white light is actually composed of these colors and that it is differently refrangible. And in 1669, Newton actually built a telescope with a big parabolic mirror to collect the light instead of just collecting light in a tube and passing it through a lens the way Galileo had done with his first telescope. And that, in fact, overcame some distortion of the image that was due to the fact that when you pass light through a lens, the colors will be bent at different amounts.
So he was seeing celestial objects in true color that way?
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll look further at the world of Sir Isaac Newton and his followers when it came to figuring out the phenomenon of light. When we return in a moment, this is University of the Air.
Simply Folk, tonight at 5 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and our guest, Peter Sobel. We're looking at light and what scientists have thought it is over the centuries. Sir Isaac Newton did quite extensive and meticulous studies of light in this question of exactly what is its nature, where did he stand?
Well, he went back and forth during his life about exactly why various optical phenomena occurred the way they did, but ultimately he believes that light is corpuscles. He called them light as these small, very small particles that stream off of bodies and are bent by going into denser bodies or are refracted around by going through the least parts of bodies.
So is he still thinking it's actually coming from the bodies as opposed to being reflected off them?
Right.
And I've heard of Newton's rings. What are that? What does that refer to?
Well, Newton's rings, a very interesting phenomenon where you take a flat piece of glass or you take a mirror, let's say. Oh, no, take a flat piece of glass. Let's do it that way. And you take A spherical piece of glass that's got a spherical surface on the bottom and is flat on the top, and you push it down on the piece of glass. And then you illuminate it from above. You can do this from below, too. And you'll see this interesting pattern, which I can't show you, but if anyone listening goes and does an image search on the web for Newton's rings, you'll get many hits. And you'll see what this looks like. It's a big, dark place in the middle where the light has passed through both pieces of glass. But then beyond that, you'll start to see these alternating rings of light and dark. And this is a serious problem for somebody who thinks that rays are streams of particles. I mean, why do you get this periodic phenomena? There was another phenomenon that puzzled Newton quite a bit, which we now call polarization or double refraction. And again, if you go and do an image search for a mineral called Icelandic spar, this was discovered in the late 17th century. And if you put a piece of this Icelandic spar down on a piece of paper with some writing on it, you'll see two images of the writing. And if you spin the crystal, you'll see one image of the writing sort of rotate around the other one. So,
what is the light doing?
Yeah, why is this happening? So, to explain Newton's rings, Newton himself was sort of pushed to propose what he called fits. And this is supposedly some sort of periodic phenomenon built into this ray of particles. It's almost the foreshadowing of a wave theory. There'll be a fit at one place. If take the Newton's ring experiment, the distance between the spherical curved piece of glass and the flat piece of glass, if it's getting larger and larger as you move away, and apparently the size of that distance is what allows light to come back or not. So there must be something, Newton believes, built into that ray that is sort of timing or paying attention to that distance. And if the fit occurs at the right moment when it hits that surface, then it passes through. If the fit isn't there, then it doesn't pass through. As far as the double refraction and the polarization, you needed some sort of symmetry to this thing. It would matter whether the beam was rotated on its axis one way or the other, and there was no obvious way for a stream of particles to do that. So Newton proposed what he called sides, that these light rays had sides. So you can almost imagine a sort of a long, thin cylinder representing the ray, but you shave off a bit of one side of the ray, and now you've got a reason why it would fit through the crystal in one way and not the other. But
it's good a guess as any.
Well, it wasn't good enough for most of his
cohorts,
most of his contemporaries.
Yeah. I suppose the concepts of light are closely tied to what people think the nature of air is, you know, whether it's ether and, you know, sort of the whole notion of what's out there.
Well, it becomes more important when people begin to think that light is a wave. Before that, and in the 17th century, they're able to do some experiments with vacuum, and they can take a bell jar and pull all the air out of it, or a lot of the air out of it, and make candles go out because there's no more oxygen. Light still goes through that. And that was one of the reasons why Newton may have retained his belief in the stream of particles. But he also played with the idea that there was some subtle thing that he called an ether. And that sort of comes and goes in his life. There are times when he works with an ether as part of his explanation for things like diffraction. If you shine light at a knife edge and then look at a screen beyond it, you can see these little fringes. Now, why is that happening? If there's an ether gradient around that knife edge, then the light is passing through that gradient can be bent out of its rectilinear path. So there might be ether in that bell jar allowing the light to go through.
They must have had fun contemplating such things as a sunset where the sun looks bigger next to the horizon or the moon.
Yeah, that's an interesting experience. The moon especially. We all have seen how large the moon looks. And we've probably all been told at some point in our lives that that's due to refraction in the atmosphere, but of course that's not the case. It's purely psychological. And I don't know that anybody back in the 17th century attributed that to anything else. It wouldn't surprise me, but I can't think of an explicit mention that
what about
this
the
is
most
due to refraction.
Dramatic appearance of light in the form of lightning. Light with sound.
Yeah. What was that? I don't really know what Newton thought about that, for example. I mean, pretty clearly it's something that even Aristotle knew about. And
I mean, would it not make some sense in the Newtonian scheme of things if the sound were a matter of these particles zipping away from the light through the ether?
I don't know. In the Middle Ages, it was acknowledged that whatever light was, they did talk about something they called species. This may be taking us back to where we've already been and in more detail than you want to go. But there were species of light and there were species of sound too. And the species of light traveled much more quickly, which is why in the example of one medieval fellow, if you watch people washing their clothes on the shore of the Seine from far away, they're beating these clothes with a stick. And you can see the blow of the stick against the river and the clothing. And then you hear it. It was pretty clear that there was this difference. So I'm guessing that people understood that about lightning and thunder. But exactly where that came from, I think, required some comparison with the kind of sparks you can get by rubbing amber on glass and getting a shock, or like we get off doorknobs when we've been walking on carpets today.
As we move into the 18th century, what do people start thinking about light waves?
Well, that's right. In the 18th century, the wave theory begins to take over because it can explain all kinds of things that are a problem for the corpuscular theory. It can explain interference. And we all did this in high school physics lab, at least I hope we did, where you see water waves come up against a sort of jetty that's got two gaps in it, and you watch the way the waves then interfere. And there's some places where the wave crest gets very big, some places the trough gets very small, and some places where it cancels out entirely, where you get nothing. And you can do this with light. You can shine it at a couple of slits, and you'll get this series of bands. And why do you get that? I mean, if light is a wave, then the analogy with water works very well. If it's particles, it's not clear why you get this at all.
And who are some of the key figures sort of in articulating light waves?
Well, it all begins very early on with the idea that light is pressure, but that didn't work out because I can look across and see you while you're looking at me, and there can't be pressure going in both directions. What there could be going in both directions was pulses. And that is proposed by a rough contemporary of Newton's named Christian Huygens, who wrote a book called The Treatise on Light in 1690, where he makes a very good argument that the undulatory theory, this wave theory of light, is the good one, is a better one.
That the light washes back and forth, it goes out from the object and then back?
No.
Just that it's flowing to you and you
perceive it. Yeah, it flows to you and you perceive it, yeah.
Was there any sense or even any reason to consider that there might be different wavelengths at this point?
Yeah, this was proposed by a man named Thomas Young, who lives across from the late 18th into the 19th century, a polymath genius type guy, instrumental in translating the Egyptian hieroglyphics. And he believed that there was this ether which the light would be a wave in. I mean, that's one of the issues with the wave theory, is there has to be something for it to be a wave in. And he believed, as Newton did in certain parts of his life, that this ether could be employed to explain not just the conduction of light, but electrical effects, magnetic effects, things like that. And he did propose that colors might be due to different frequencies of vibration in the ether.
Are we still thinking in terms of the item itself generating the light or the light being somehow reflected?
Well, at this point, light comes from sources because the source is able, like a flame or the sun, is able to induce these vibrations. And then the vibrations hit a colored thing and the vibration would be modified somehow by that color.
But so that if you're seeing another person, is the theory still that that person is generating the light?
No, that's a good question. I don't know exactly when the idea. I don't think anybody ever really believed that you generate your own light. But the idea that things radiate their nature, which was an important part of vision theory early on. But vision always did require an illumination of some kind. It was just a special case of this radiation of one's nature.
Do they have a sense that the sun is different from other objects in that it just might radiate its own light?
Oh, yeah. The sun is clearly self-luminous, and the moon is not. And this was known pretty early on, that the moon just reflects light from the sun.
And where does Faraday fit into this?
Michael Faraday. Well, Faraday is a very interesting fellow. He's the son of a bookbinder and works his way into the Royal Institution and turns into this experimental genius. And Faraday was taken especially with these things called Chladni figures. And you may have done this in high school physics too. You take a metal plate or a glass plate and you sprinkle fine sand on it and then draw a violin bow along the sand.
You had a better high school physics class than I did. I don't remember my high school physics class.
Well, if you do this, you get these amazingly beautiful patterns in the sand, which are due to the vibration that the violin bow creates in the glass. So Faraday never really lost this fascination with waves. Things were waves made great sense to him. And especially if you take, surely, if you take a magnet, you put a piece of paper over the magnet and put iron filings down there, you see these lines of force, Faraday called them. And he was happy to believe that those lines could conduct vibrations and gave a famous paper, a talk in 1846. This is a funny story, which I have to tell. He was in the back room of the Royal Institution with a man named Wheatstone. And Wheatstone was going to go first, and then Faraday was going to get up and talk about just some experiment he had done. And Wheatstone was a nervous fellow and fled. To this day, I'm told by an eminent Faraday scholar, the Royal Institution guest speakers are locked in the antechamber to prevent this
once
from happening.
Once burned.
Yeah, but then it was sort of fortunate for this point in history because Faraday got up there and with all this time to fill was compelled to sort of go out and free associate and tell people what he was thinking. These were just hypotheses that he had. So it was called Thoughts on Ray Vibrations. And this was then read by James Clerk Maxwell, who was probably the most important scientist of the 19th century, at least in the physical sciences. And he's reading Faraday and is fascinated by these experiments and believes the undulatory theory of light. He knows that Faraday was actually able to rotate a beam of polarized light by putting it in a magnetic field. So this overlap between light and electromagnetism is quite suggestive of a common medium for both things. And he writes, I have this quote here, "If it should be found that the velocity of propagation of electromagnetic disturbances is the same as the velocity of light, we shall have strong reasons for believing that light is an electromagnetic phenomenon."
True.
And yeah. But when this was found to be the case, it really solidified in his mind and in just about everybody else's that there must be an ether for these things to be a wave in.
Something to carry it.
Yeah.
What are some of the other experiments that are done to push it further?
Well, if there's an ether, then we ought to be able to detect it because it's probably the universal reference frame. It's probably at rest in the universe. And since we know that the Earth is moving around the sun, and by this point we even know that the sun is moving around the center of the galaxy, that we can detect it. We can detect ether drift by looking. We have a light source, and again, if you do an image search for the Michelson-Morley experiment, you'll see an interesting diagram where light is emitted from a source and sent through a half-silvered mirror, so half of the light goes through the mirror and the other half of the light goes away at 90 degrees. And they then, both beams of light, go the same distance and they hit mirrors and come back. And then because it's a half-silvered mirror, some of each beam will then go to a detector.
And what does that prove?
Well, you look at the interference pattern that it causes and you take note of that, and then you rotate the whole apparatus 90 degrees. And that should change the interference pattern. If the Earth is moving in the direction of one of the arms of the experiment going through the ether. And initially, when this was done in the basement of a building on the campus of Case Western Reserve in 1887, there wasn't a big result. Some people actually believed that there was enough of a result to show that there was ether, but there was enough of a concern, at least on the part of Professors Michelson and Morley, to do the experiment again, this time on top of Mount Wilson in 1905, because they thought maybe in the basement of Case Western you're immersed in ether which is carried along by the Earth through the sort of universal ether, and that if you get up on a mountaintop, maybe you'll be getting away from the stationary ether and sort of stuck near the surface of the Earth and more of a drag will be noticed. But there still was no very positive result at that time.
How are the experiments on light linked to those on heat?
There was this theoretical entity called a black body, which will absorb any radiation that strikes it and will emit radiation, a certain frequency of radiation, depending upon how much energy this black body has. So as you heat it up, it will begin emitting radiation, and first it will be red hot, and then it'll be yellow hot, and then it gets blue and then white. The hotter it gets, the smaller frequency, more high energy radiation it emits. Now, how can you explain this? How can you construct a law based on what is now understood about thermodynamics that relates the energy pumped into the black body to the color of light that it emits? No one was able to do this. All the attempts to crank out these laws failed. Until Max Planck, sort of in desperation, said to himself, all right, let's assume that energy only can exist in little packages that are multiples of this very small number, which we now call Planck's constant. Very, very, very small number, 6.6 times 10 to the minus 27 erg seconds. It's a measure of energy. So,
tiny.
But lo and behold, if you think of energy as quantizable in this way, it is possible to construct a law that ties the energy pumped into the black body with the frequency of radiation that it emits. So this has consequences for the nature of light. Another experiment, it begins as just a phenomenon. It was noticed that if you have an arc lamp with some metal electrodes, you can pump electricity, create a potential on either side of that, and you'll get a spark. Heinrich Hertz noticed that it's easier to get a spark if you're shining ultraviolet light on these electrodes. And it later was found out that you can eject electrons from metal by shining light on them, but the light had to have a particular frequency. There was a threshold frequency. Less energetic light would emit no electrons at all from this metal, no matter how intense the light was. But as soon as you went up a notch, or the frequency became smaller, energy becomes larger, then you can start getting electrons off. And this boundary, this threshold level is a signature for each kind of metal where you can do this. So what the heck is going on here? And this was explained by Einstein.
And we'll take a look at Einstein and light when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year.
Our website, WPR.org, features thousands of hours of archived audio. When you miss a program on our Ideas Network, it's a good bet you can listen later on the web. Programs are available at WPR.org. Click our audio archives.
In the beginning, there was nothing. God said, let there be light, and there was light. There was still nothing, but you could see it a whole lot better. That's a comment by Ellen DeGeneres. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Peter Sobel, and we're talking about the history of light. We just mentioned Einstein. How does Einstein add to the conversation on light?
Well, one of Einstein's earliest brilliant observations was to take a look at this photoelectric effect and sort of apply what Planck had discovered and propose that whatever light is arriving at this metal must itself also be in little packages of discrete size, so that if you're sending packages that are just too small, to dislodge an electron. It doesn't matter how many of them you send. You have to send them with the requisite amount of energy.
Did he have a name for this unit of light?
He didn't come up with that name right away. He just called them quanta, I believe, light quanta. The name photon is coined later on, I think, in 1926 by someone else whose name escapes me for the moment. But yeah, that eventually becomes the photon. And then it becomes, this is sort of tangential to the history of what light is, but it's part of Einstein's general theory of relativity that light beams will be bent by gravity because
right.
it's actually a curvature of space-time and you should be able to see this. And it was fairly difficult to confirm this. Some people claimed that it could not be confirmed or that their attempt had failed. But then finally in 1919, a solar eclipse was observed by the astronomer Arthur Eddington. And that's a great way to do this because the sun is not blocking your view then of what stars are behind it. And if the stars are now in a different place than they are when the sun's not there, then pretty clearly the presence of the sun has deflected the path of the light from the stars to you. And that has been confirmed.
What are some of the other important advances in the 20th century?
Well, light, if you thought light was strange now, strange then. I mean, again, it's so much fun to look at this because light has been strange to everybody. And it stays strange in the 20th century and gets even stranger in the 21st.
Is the debate at all between energy versus matter, light having one characteristic or the other?
No, I mean, after Einstein, it's pretty clear that mass and energy are convertible and that if you want to think about it that way, photons have mass in that they are bent by gravity. The real issue comes up with quantum mechanics. There's a working out of quantum mechanics mathematically that leads to some fairly surprising and extremely counterintuitive results. And one of these is a phenomenon called entanglement, where two particles, and this works with photons. There are events where you produce two entangled photons that go off in different directions. Although it's not clear that to think of them as two separate things is really correct. They remain as kind of a unit. And if you leave them alone and you don't know which way either one of them is polarized, then they go off their merry way. But as soon as you detect the polarized direction of one, you already know the polarized direction of the other. Well, Einstein didn't like this aspect of quantum mechanics. As he famously has said, God doesn't play dice with the universe, although he doesn't really express any sort of belief in a deity there. He just was using that as a metaphor to say that the universe can't be that problematic at its basis. There must be something. There must be some law there that we yet don't understand. And this led to a paper in 1935 with the title, Can Quantum Mechanical Description of Physical Reality Be Considered Complete? And in this paper, an experiment is proposed which became known as the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen experiment after the names of the authors of the paper. It's quite likely, by the way, Einstein didn't really contribute much to writing it, but his name had to go first because they were his grad students, of course. And in this paper, it's proposed that this is the very thing that I've described, that you have an event that produces two photons. How is it possible that detecting the polarization direction of one allows the other one to know which direction of polarization it must assume? It's almost as if the two are talking to each other over vast distances instantaneously.
Yeah, how odd.
Yes, capital O odd. That is true. Einstein referred to this as spooky action at a distance. But, in fact, decades later, when some math was improved or cleaned up in some way by a scientist named John Bell, this experiment was actually constructed and carried out. And lo and behold, these two photons remain as a single unit in that you don't really know which is rotated, which is polarized one way. And then if you detect the polarization of one, the other one automatically snaps into that other 90 degrees away polarization.
And how would Einstein and his graduate students have defined light at this point? If they had to give a, you know, one or two sentence definition of light is what?
Well, light is electromagnetic wave. I mean, it definitely has these wave properties, but it is also something that can be affected by gravity. But it has this orientation in space. There's an electric wave and a magnetic wave, and they sort of reinforce each other, and this all comes out of the work of Faraday and Maxwell. But you can orient this thing. It can rotate. In fact, circular polarization is one of the things you can do with light waves. Along its axis of travel, you can have this transverse electric wave rotating around the axis, which is the direction of travel. Or it can be stuck in one orientation. In fact, it can assume any of these orientations. The two photons produced in the quantum event have polarizations that are 90 degrees apart. Now, the spooky thing about this is it's a consequence of quantum mechanics that there are certain pairs of properties that you can't know both of at any one time. The one we all learn about is that you can't know the position and momentum of a particle, of a subatomic particle, with the same experiment. As soon as you figure out the position, you can't possibly figure out its momentum, and vice versa. It also turns out that if you're doing experiments with light, you can't shine light at one of these two slit experiments where we get the interference pattern and both get an interference pattern and know which slit the photon went through. As soon as you try to figure out which slit each individual photon is going through, you don't get an interference pattern anymore. This is really very strange. There are light emitters now that will emit a single photon at a time. And if you shine this thing at a two-slit experiment, one photon, bing, another photon, bing, and just let it go for a while, you will eventually construct on a screen behind it or any whatever detector you're using, you'll get these fringes, these bands of an interference pattern. So it's one photon. What is it interfering with to make these patterns? But if you cover up a slit and just shine light at one slit or the other with the other slit covered, you don't get the interference. And now it really starts to get spooky. A physicist named John Wheeler proposed in 1978, what if we cover up one of the slits but only after the photon has gone by? Hasn't hit the detector yet. It just goes past the slits, and then we close one of them.
You have to move fast to do that, don't you?
Yep, but we've learned how to do that. We've learned how to be that fast. I mean, we know how fast light goes now. We've sort of missed out on that part of the story.
And but what are we going to learn by covering up the slit after the photon has
passed?
Well,
what do you think will happen? I mean, you would think that
it's
after it's gone
happened,
by, it's already happened.
Yeah.
But this experiment actually could not be carried out until the year 2000, and it's been carried out several times since then. And this is called a delayed choice experiment, where you cover up one of the slits after the photon has gone by, but before it hits the detector. And if you do that, you don't get interference.
Proving what?
Well, somehow the photon knows that the slit wasn't there when it hits the detector. Now, of course, this is...
Maybe the photon has a tail.
That's a good theory, Norman. I don't know that anyone's ever considered that before. How long is the tail? We'd want to know that. So this is very spooky. And it gets even spookier. And I almost hesitate to broach this one. But the final experiment that I would mention in this regard is something called a quantum eraser. And I found what I consider to be a pretty good and clear explanation of a quantum eraser experiment, and it's at the following website. This was actually done back in 2002. There may be better ones out there, but I thought this one was fairly clear. This was done at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. So if you go to the following URL, http://grad.physics.sunysb.edu/ AMARCH.
And we'll put that on our website as a link.
This will link you to a non-mathematical explanation of what they did. And if you want to see the math, there's a link to the actual paper that was published. Now, do I dare attempt this? I don't know.
Hang on.
All right. In this experiment, there is a source of light which is then sent through a particular kind of crystal that produces one of these quantum events, and two photons come out. And one photon just goes to a detector, and another photon goes at a two-slit setup. And there's a counter so that pairs of photons are kept sort of coordinated. And if you just do this way, they don't have a screen in the back of the two slits. They have a detector that they move 1 millimeter at a time. So it's sort of sliding across the back of the two slits. I think they do 400 photons, and then they move it a millimeter, 400, and then they move it again. And then if a graph is made of where in that travel photons arrived, it goes up and comes down and goes up and comes down. It's clearly an interference pattern. Okay, now it gets interesting. Now, if you put some apparatus, I won't go into detail here, you put some apparatus in front of the two slits, something called quarter wave plates, so that you know that an incoming photon with a particular polarization will then be polarized one way, and if it's coming in with the opposite polarization, it'll be polarized another way. This allows you to, in principle, okay, only in principle, know which slit the photon went through. Provided, of course, that you're looking at the polarization of the other photon, the one that's not going through. If you detect the polarization of that one, because these are entangled, you know the polarization of the one headed toward the two slits.
By definition.
Yeah. But no record is kept, no measurement is made. It's just putting these things in front of these photons, and lo and behold, the interference pattern goes away, and it's just this big bump.
Leaving you to conclude what?
Well, no one knows what to conclude about this. Or at least if anyone's figured this out, it's news to me. I think the only reasonable conclusion at this point is that these entangled photons are really not properly considered separate objects. They are manifestations of a single thing somehow. I mean, you could be doing these detections theoretically at opposite ends of the universe, and it would still come out the same way.
The overall implication seeming to be that things are more connected than we realized
up
to this point.
Well, certainly for entangled pairs, that is a connection that isn't achieved by anything else. It's certainly not in furniture-sized nature that we know about. So
what adjectives would you use to describe light as we conclude this?
Other than mysterious.
Spooky has come up a few times.
Spooky and mysterious are both very good. I mean, nothing else is probably as easy to manipulate for us in some senses. I mean, I'm wearing glasses. I've worn them all my life. They help me see. We make movies. We make television. We make telescopes and microscopes. And yet, down at the bottom, down at this tiny level, what is really going on there is still a huge mystery.
Thanks for sharing some of it with us, Peter. Peter Sobel has been our guest for this hour.
Well, thank you, Norman. Always a pleasure.
I was going to say, very enlightening. Somehow.
Or illuminating.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.